This presentation has been previously broadcast.
The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show.
On Relevant Radio.
First, we are in regular touch with these social media platforms, and those engagements typically happen through members of our senior staff, but also members of our COVID-19 team. Given, as Dr. Murthy conveyed, this is a big issue of misinformation, specifically on the pandemic. In terms of actions, Alex, that we have taken, or we're working to take, I should say, from the federal government, we've increased disinformation research and tracking within the Surgeon General's office. We're flagging problematic posts for Facebook that spread disinformation.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Welcome to the Drew Mariani Show. I'm Sheila Logmina. So happy to be here with you today. So happy that you're tuned in right now because we're going to cover a lot. I'm a journalist, longtime journalist, broadcaster, and all the news coverage I do every day, the news sweeping and gathering, covers so much. I think too much to cover in too little time, anything on any platform that I cover. However, we've got a full three hours today of a lot of the coverage you need to hear about stories you might be hearing in other media, but you hear it in a wholly different way here on Relevant Radio. So getting to that point of what you heard at the open, that was, of course, White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki. So we all know we're going to cover many stories today that are of that kind of import. But on that story, we all know social media is cracking down on conservatives with all kinds of censorship. I've seen articles over the weekend. Washington Post put out an investigative report on spyware and hacking some people's email accounts and so forth. And then the New York Times came out shortly after the Washington Post and kind of plucked out of the Washington Post's the fact that article that there was nothing mentioned about a key, just say, connection. And I thought that's interesting. The New York Times kind of correcting the Washington Post. This is getting to be interesting, folks. So we all know social media is cracking down on conservatives in particular with censorship. The only time that's in dispute is when social media representatives show up before Congress and have to answer questions about that fact. You've watched that, right? When some of them have sat before members of Congress answering their questions. The argument from the social media gurus is that these are private companies, so they're not subject to the limitations placed on the government by the First Amendment. That amendment, of course, says Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech or of the press. So private companies are free to do that. But what happens when the government begins to tell those private companies what speech the government wants suppressed? Oh, wow, we have a clash. We've seen this happen with social media companies in places like China and other dictatorial countries. But we learned from White House spokeswoman Jen Psaki last week, press secretary, that this is happening here in this country as well. So at a press briefing on Thursday, Psaki said in response to a reporter's question, we're flagging problematic posts for Facebook that spreads disinformation or that spread disinformation. That raises things to a whole other level, doesn't it? When you look at those words keenly and listen to them keenly, we're flagging problematic posts for Facebook that spread disinformation. Well, define disinformation. Eugene Volokh is the Gary Schwartz Professor of Law at the UCLA School of Law. He joins me now. He's the author of the column, The Volokh Controversy, and teaches free speech, tort, religious freedom, and church-state relations law. Eugene, welcome to the program. I'm glad you're here. We need your voice.
Very glad to have been invited. One thing I should just mention, the name of our blog is The Volokh Conspiracy. It's an old joke referring back to you. Hillary Clinton complained about the vast right-wing conspiracy, so we thought we'd embrace that.
Why not embrace it?
Once you find it, it's under Volokh Conspiracy, and we're now hosted at Reason Magazine.
The Volokh Conspiracy at Reason Magazine, and we need reason, don't we? It's a rare commodity. It's like common sense, Eugene, is not common anymore. But so the Volokh Conspiracy is found at Reason Magazine. So, Eugene, let's talk about what the White House itself said through Jen Psaki. We're flagging problematic posts for Facebook that spread disinformation. Private companies, of course, aren't subject to the First Amendment, believe it or not. Former President Donald Trump is suing big tech himself because of censorship. How far will that suit go? Let's start with that.
Well, I think it's an uphill battle, very much an uphill battle, although there is a theory under which it might prevail. The general rule is that the government is free to speak out itself, to condemn speech, to say, you know, we don't like this kind of speech. And even we want to encourage all good citizens not to engage in this speech or not to carry their speech. That kind of exhortation, that kind of encouragement of speech restriction is not unconstitutional, courts say. Indeed, if anything, it's just the expression of legislators or government officials' own ideas. It's their own speech. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, when it gets to be coercion, essentially telling third parties, look, if you carry this speech, well, things will be bad for you. We're going to look into your finances, maybe. We're going to block your permit or application requests or something along those lines. Mm-hmm. That becomes unconstitutional if applied to constitutionally protected speech. So the difficulty, of course, is that when the government says things to people, there's often some element of potential coercion, right? You're always worried what the government might be able to do to you if you don't go along with what it asks. This having been said, courts say a line needs to be drawn. Often the line is drawn in favor of allowing government officials to speak to condemn speech, to condemn people's speech and the like. So it's a complicated question and involves difficult line drawing that is often not easy to predict the outcome of.
Well, no, of course. I mean, no kidding. It's interesting, Eugene. I was watching the different times, say, Mark Zuckerberg went before Congress and was interrogated by members up there on the panel. And it's just amazing. He prepared himself to answer each member of Congress well, and or at least to the best of his ability. And then go back, and it seemed to me in no time, social media was kind of laughing at all the members of Congress who they felt were unprepared, the people who posted that anyway, posted their follow-up remarks about watching that. So it's almost like, okay, so are they prepared when they question them? And everybody has that sense, Eugene, that something needs to happen to have some regulation, some regulatory, if not laws, just regulatory measures. But that, you know, you can't go too far. It's kind of that catch-22. You can't go too far and then abridge or curtail freedom of speech unless it's speech that agrees with your opinions, ideologies, policies. And so that's where people are wondering where you draw the line. On that note, can a government agency tell these private companies what they want censored?
Well, again, it all depends on what you mean by tell.
Right.
It's tell in the sense of the boss telling an employee, I'm telling you, you need to do that. The answer is no. That the government can't go to private entities and say, you must censor this. Or even, you'd better censor this or else. There was a case called Bantam Books v. Sullivan from the early 1960s, where there was a commission that was set up to fight pornography. And it would send basically threatening letters in the government's name to bookstores that would carry books that the commission viewed as pornographic. Many of those books were fully constitutionally protected, but the commission didn't like them, and it threatened the bookstores. And the court says, look, even though they didn't actually prosecute the bookstores, a threat of prosecution, mm-hmm. that's enough to make that kind of action unconstitutional. On the other hand, let's say the government, my understanding this happens not infrequently, government official calls up the New York Times and says, look, I understand you're about to write this story about this national security matter, and if you write it, let me just tell you, it's going to be really bad for this covert action we're doing or something like that. We know we don't have the power to force you to block this story, but we're asking you as fellow patriotic Americans, can you do that? Or let's say law enforcement calls up a newspaper and says, look, we know you have certain information that you got about an investigation, but if you publish it, that's going to tip off the criminals. Or maybe it's going to make it harder for us to tell whether the people coming forward to confess are actually just kooks whether they really did it, because there's particular information about the crime that we want to withhold so we can better identify that. You know, if that's what the law enforcement says to the newspapers, and it's understood that that is just a request and not a threat, then in that case, that's generally speaking permissible.
On that note, Eugene, if you just tuned in, I'm Sheila Logmanis in for Drew today, talking with Eugene Volokh, the author of the column The Volokh Conspiracy at Reason Magazine. He teaches free speech, tort, religious freedom, and church-state relations law, an expert in the subject we're on right now, social media censorship of certain groups of people in particular. So as a long time journalist, Eugene, I've covered all of it, started out many long years ago at a newspaper, went from there to television, was in television for quite a while, and then came on to magazine report. I worked for Time Magazine for 20 years as a Time reporter, and then now radio. So, you know, so I know these things, and I know what you're talking about, and that it's changed so much. People know that, how much media have changed, the different media, how much the whole industry has changed, Eugene. And what you're saying, when the government at least goes to, say, the New York Times, I know we've learned that you're going to go forward with, you're going to publish an investigative series or report you've been researching. We just want to prevail upon you with the knowledge that doing so could jeopardize, you know, this or this. That used to work very differently, Eugene, than it does now. So what is that like these days? You tell them, New York Times, Washington Post, that kind of relationship between government and big media. And now we add to that whole complex topic, social media. So you've got, you know, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, you've got other ways that information's getting out, the blogs, podcasts, information's getting out there. How is that today versus what you just described?
Well, I can't tell you to how the media have changed in their responses to this. I'm not a student of how media operate in that respect. I can tell you that as a legal matter, the rules, at least the official rules, seem to be the same now as back then, which is, again, urging restrictions on speech, asking for restrictions on speech, encouraging such restrictions. That's fine. Threatening retaliation unless the media block a story or something along those lines, or pull a story, that's unconstitutional. Now, I should tell you that there are other analogies from other areas of the law that seem to cut the opposite direction. So, for example, the Fourth Amendment, which controls searches and seizures, like the First Amendment, only applies to the government. So if, for example, some private person rummages through your papers and then sees something that's evidence of crime and sends it along to the police, that's not a Fourth Amendment violation, because that's a private search. But courts have said that if the police encourage someone go through somebody's papers, that becomes a Fourth Amendment violation, because that person is operating kind of like a cat's paw of the government. So if the police say, you know, we really need to get some information about your roommate, but we don't have enough to get a warrant ourselves, I'm wondering, could you maybe go and rummage through the roommate's papers? And you do that, then that becomes government action. That becomes subject to the Fourth Amendment. So if you want to apply that theory to the First Amendment, that encouraging private restrictions would also be potentially unconstitutional. That's just not the way the courts so far have dealt with the matter.
Yeah, social media has really changed just everything. I mean, you know, print media, even the former broadsheet, New York Times, Washington Post, not that they aren't still out there in that way, but now so much is online, and then so much is social media driven. On social media, Eugene, especially with recent headlines and even all the way through over the weekend, how much are social media companies doing, let's say, the bidding of overseas governments?
I don't know. At least I don't know what it's like in the U.S. My understanding is that in many foreign countries, they are doing the bidding of the foreign governments, in the sense that if they're operating in France or Turkey or Russia or someplace like that. My understanding is there's a big controversy about this in India. You know, those countries have their own rules for what's allowed in that country. And I think, as I understand it, many such companies say, look, if something is illegal in Turkey, we will block access to it from Turkey. If it's illegal in India, we will block access to it from India. The harder question, which I think is what you're asking, is what happens if the Chinese government or the Indian government or Turkish or Saudi government pressures American social media companies to block certain speech in America itself? So that our criticisms of, say, maybe the Chinese government would be blocked because the Chinese government is threatening those companies with retaliation. I don't know to what extent they're doing that. The suspicion is they might be because they have to, in order to protect their business, they have to kind of to satisfy every government of every country in which they operate and have assets and have employees. So potentially it's something that is that could be a quite a serious problem. My understanding is that, in fact, Zoom, as I understand it, was accused of blocking certain kinds of things in the U.S. at the behest of the Chinese government, so certain kinds of video conferences. So this is a really serious threat. I'm not sure anybody really fully knows the scope of that, though.
You know, probably we can't, because it's just the way it's done, the nature of it. We probably can't know the scope. But there's an awful lot out there that we, you know, we can see, and then people like yourself who have more expertise can surmise, and you certainly know law on that. In fact, Eugene, on law, you know, some people would use the argument that right now, this government intervention is to stop the spread, some people would use the argument, to stop the spread of disinformation. When we opened and talked about Jen Psaki at the White House saying, you know, White House, we're flagging problematic posts for Facebook that spread disinformation. So some people would use the argument that this government intervention is to stop the spread of disinformation about COVID. But what's to stop the government, Eugene, from demanding more? Let's say what they call disinformation about, say, guns or gun rights or the Second Amendment?
Right. So I think the answer turns on this word you said, you used demanding. If the government demands, in the sense of backed with some threat of retaliation, if the government demands that a certain material be taken down, that's government action restricting speech. And at that point, there could be a lawsuit blocking such demands, basically saying, look, prove that this speech is constitutionally unprotected. And if it is protected, and much of the supposed disinformation is constitutionally protected opinion, even if we think it's foolish opinion, then in that case you can't demand that it be taken down. But what if it's not demand, but request, exhort, urge, encourage? Well, yes, the government is free to encourage people to block speech that supports gun rights, or block speech that supports takes a wide range of other positions. There was a case from the 1980s where there was a board game kind of mocking welfare recipients, and there was a New York City government official that sent letters to various stores urging it not to carry the game. And the court said that's permissible. It didn't demand it. He didn't threaten retaliation. He just sent such letters. Likewise, there was the Commission on Pornography, the Mies Commission on Pornography during the Reagan administration, which sent letters to various outlets such as 7-Eleven, urging them to stop selling material that they saw as pornographic. That was challenged by Penthouse Magazine, and the court said, look, they weren't ordering anybody stop carrying this kind of material. All they were saying is, we wish you would stop carrying it, and that's constitutionally permissible.
Well, so what's permissible in the world of social media these days, and what's not permissible, is really keenly on people's minds what's happening behind behind the scenes when they're using social media. People are very, worried, and they're very worried about it being even on that platform. So, Is this an issue, Eugene? It probably is for a very long. It has been for a very long time. I remember Pippa and, you know, the social media initial efforts at regulation. SOPA and PIPA, I think. And I did a blog post on that and wound up on the BBC to talk about that because they saw that and called me and asked me to be on the BBC. But that goes so far back. And it, so Eugene, is it like an effort time and again? They go round and round in members of Congress here and then in other countries in Europe. I know they're looking at this too with this delicate question of how to regulate it without overstepping free speech.
Well, there are two separate questions here, I think. One is, what kind of speech is permissibly regulated online?
Mm-hmm.
And the answer is the First Amendment protects a very broad range of speech. There are a few exceptions, pretty much the same online as offline. But for example, child pornography can be permissibly regulated online or banned online as well as offline. Libel can be restricted online as well as offline. Expression of opinions about COVID, even ones that run contrary to conventional wisdom, even ones that we probably think are wrong and foolish, that's constitutionally protected online as well as offline. So if the question is what the government may actually outright regulate online, the answer is a few things, but relatively few. There's a separate question of when something can't be regulated by the government, can the government still encourage these intermediaries to block this kind of speech? And the answer seems to be from the cases, yes. And this is a power that could very well be abused by the government and by the social media platforms, but it's something that that the government is, generally speaking, allowed to do, so long as it's actually just encouraging rather than demanding or threatening. And of course, one difficulty is when the president's office, which runs the Justice Department and the rest of the federal government, to which a social media platform is maybe applying to for all sorts of clearances, like for regard to mergers, clearances from antitrust enforcers and the like, is that something that's inherently likely to be threatening?
Mm-hmm.
It's a plausible argument. It's just so far courts have said, nope, we need something more than just this general worry that people always have whenever the government asks them to do something.
And when you bring up courts looking for, we need more than just generally people, we're out of time. But real quick answer to this. Do you see anything making its way through the court system right now that might be that?
Well, the Trump lawsuit is indeed claiming that the government
that?
Basically implicitly threatened the social media platforms.
Okay.
If they didn't, it didn't block his account. I doubt
okay.
he'll prevail on the facts, but it's interesting.
Okay.
Perhaps
we're out of time. Thank you, Eugene Volokh. Thank you so much.
Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/forester.
The truth. Unfiltered. It's the Drew Mariani Show.
Relevant Radio.
On Relevant Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Sheila Logminas in for Drew today. Happy to be here. So happy you're there as well. Boy, that conversation in the first half of this hour was really interesting about the White House teaming up with social media to censor posts on social media. You know, you got to be careful about that, and we always should be. That's communications is a moral act. John Paul II wrote about that, and that's very true. And it's important that we always keep that in mind in our posts. Well, switching gears right now, like I told you at the beginning, there's a lot of news out there to cover. Very important, more than one can fit in a whole day of coverage. However, you need to hear the heart of the matter that you're not always hearing in other media. So one of those is on the deferred action for childhood arrivals in the immigration world of issues, shorthand known as DACA. On Friday of last week, a federal judge in Texas blocked new applications for DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, that had been instituted under then-President Barack Obama. DACA was started, if you recall, or I'll recall you to that, was started to deal with children who have come to the United States illegally, but who were minors when they crossed the border, so their parents brought them. Before DACA was started, these children could be deported back to their country of origin once they reached the age of 18. But some of them have been living here almost their entire lives. The suit was filed by Texas. Lawsuit was filed by Texas and other states saying that by implementing that program, President Obama violated the Constitution by undermining Congress's authority on immigration. According to The Hill, you might know The Hill, hill.com. It's a news outlet that different voices, left and right, or political persuasion, post articles there, something to read. According to The Hill, the judge ruled that DACA violated the Administrative Procedure Act. But he also recognized that hundreds of thousands of people are dependent on this program. So he left it in place for now. But it could impact the many thousands who've applied for the program, but whose application's still pending. It's really, you know, kind of mired, right? But you don't hear this kind of, I don't know, parsing apart all of the entangled parts. So on top of all that, Customs and Border Patrol announced on Friday that there have been more than 1 million arrests along the border. So, did you know that? Since the fiscal year started in October. More than 1 million arrests along the border since October. Last month, there were nearly 189,000 people, 189,000 people who illegally crossed the border, a 5% increase from May. That's the highest monthly total in nearly 20 years. Well, Dylan Corbett is the executive director of the Hope Border Institute, which you can find at hopeborder.org. He joins me now. Dylan, welcome.
Hi, Sheila. Good to be with you. Thank you.
It's really great to have you here. What was the judge's reasoning for saying that the provisions in DACA aren't constitutionally valid?
Well, it's a little complex. You have to get into the legalese. But basically, what the judge is saying here is that President Obama exceeded his authority. Because immigration really is the responsibility of Congress, that in his opinion that President Obama just overstepped his authority. And so there are problems, legal technical problems with this program. But it'll make its way through the court. The Supreme Court, heard a DACA case once and really didn't take a position on it. When the Trump administration tried to cancel DACA, the Supreme Court kind of sidestepped the issue, not taking up the issue directly, taking issue more with how the Trump administration tried to cancel it. So we might see this proceed up to the Supreme Court, but it's really something that Congress really does have to take care of. This is not a stable position for DACA recipients to be in, where they're sort of at the whims of different interpretations in the courts.
That's really important that they're at the whims of interpretations of different courts, because we know on any number of issues, and especially life issues, religious freedom issues, and freedom of speech issues, right, Dylan, that depending on which court you're in, it can go one way or another because of what many people have called judicial advocacy, and where they really just need to follow the law instead of being, involved ideologically in some of these issues. But so making its way through the court system can be hard to navigate. In the last 9 months, being that there have been 1 million people arrested, so a lot of people don't know this, Dylan, more than 1 million people arrested at the, or about 1 million people arrested at the border. How many of those have been minors? Let's get into the minors issue of the, because that's what DACA is about, the children.
Yeah, it's important to note that that we have among those who are beneficiaries of DACA, and there are more than 600,000 of them. They did come as children, but because there has been so much inaction, we're talking about decades of inaction in some cases on this. Many of these people are at the point where they're having families. They're trying to set down roots in the community. They're looking at very difficult questions about work, where they're going to work, what community they're going to settle down in, and having a family and setting down roots. And so this type of instability can be really maddening. And as you say, we need to get it out of the courts. We need some clarity on the issue. Now, children are still coming to the border. As you mentioned, there have been a number of arrests. A significantly high number of arrests this year of those who are coming to the border. There were about 15,000, just over 15,000 unaccompanied children who came to the border in June, which is a bit higher than May. So we're still dealing with the reality of unaccompanied minors, youth and children who are coming to the border seeking protection. Now, the numbers are a little hard to understand if you don't have context. You kind of have to drill down a little bit because, as you said, this year, which is the fiscal year that the government goes by, which ends, I think, in September, we're looking at already more than a million apprehensions at the border. But if you sort of drill down and understand that many of those people are repeat border crossers, so the figures from last year, about one-third, a little more than one-third of those represent repeat border attempts. So someone might try to cross the border one, two. I met a woman recently who crossed the border, tried to cross the border eight times. So those numbers are a little bit inflated, but if you sort of look at the number of actual individuals who've been apprehended at the border, it plummets down to just over 400,000, which is a little less, actually, than it was last year. The reason for those repeat border crossings is because we still have a pandemic-related health order at the border, which restricts travel across the border, and that affects many of those who are coming to the border seeking protection, like asylum seekers. So, what happens if you're an asylum seeker or an asylum-seeking family? You may be returned to Mexico pretty rapidly under this policy, which is called Title 42, and so that may mean that you try to cross multiple times. That's really putting a burden and a strain on CBP, on Border Patrol at the border, because they're apprehending folks over and over and over again. So it's a significant thing, but it's really related to this Title 42 health order, which has been in place now for over a year, but which may be rescinded in the coming months under this administration.
So, by the way, I'm Sheila Logminas in for Drew today. My guest is Dylan Corbett, Executive Director of the Hope Border Institute, which you can find at hopeborder.org. We'll get into that. There's a lot there about border and justice, Border Truth and Justice Initiative. In fact, you have that. We'll get to that, Dylan. But people feel very strongly about this, and yet a lot of those strong feelings don't come from a widespread base of information. Of course, how many people can dive deep and get that information? They hear what they hear in different kinds of news that feed more likely into their own vision of things without knowing, okay, let me hear what each side is saying in this issue and make up my mind. Let's see what the church teaches on this issue of, you know, justice and rights, human rights and so forth. And this is what we need to do. That's why we're taking the deeper dive. But Dylan Corbett is the director of Hope Border Institute. We're talking about DACA. In fact, on Friday of last week, if you just tuned in, federal judge in Texas blocked new applications for the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program. You know that as DACA, folks. And that was instituted under then-President Obama. So Customs and Border Patrol also announced the other day that there have been more than a million arrests. And Dylan just broke that down. You know, some are repeat crossers. So he's breaking all of this down for us. And we know, you know, you have a lot of feelings about this as well. So the number here is 888-914-9149. If you want to join me and have questions for Dylan, 888-914-9149. Dylan, so assuming the DACA decision is going to be appealed, because you talked about it making its way possibly even to the Supreme Court, what happens if it is and then it's struck down by the Supreme Court?
Yeah, so I think what we can expect is that the Biden administration will appeal this decision, and it may go, you know, this may be something that goes back to the Supreme Court for ruling. And we really don't know how the Supreme Court will rule. As I said, they sort of punted the last time they looked at this, and were concerned more with how the Trump administration was attempting to suspend the program. And that's actually something that this federal judge right now in Texas was concerned with, how the Obama administration put into place the program originally. They sort of sidestepped some of the processes that you would usually do to do this, like taking public comment. So it's really a procedural issue, but the Supreme Court could take it up, could look at the merits of it, and it's really hard to say. As you said, so many of these issues, they become politicized, they go through the courts, different circuits and so forth, and it's hard to say, you know, what will happen, if the case will be taken up by the Supreme Court, when it will, or how they'll rule. What we know is that really the situation of having Dreamers, of having DACA recipients, of having a population of 11 million people without documents in the country, is really unsustainable long term. It's something that we do need to address. We need to, these folks, as they do, as they're trying to deal with questions of education and jobs and family and setting down roots and so forth, they're living in real instability. Mm-hmm. And so ultimately, at the end of the day, it's not administrative action that we need. It's something that needs to be decided in Congress. And so hopefully Congress will get to that point.
Have they begun to?
Well, there are some proposals right now. Of course, Congress is taking up the question of infrastructure and jobs, and so there have been some people who have said, that we might look at reconciliation if it gets to the point where Congress is not able to act on the jobs and infrastructure mm-hmm. bill. Something might be done through reconciliation. If that happens, then there might be an attempt to get some legal protections for DACA and maybe some of the other groups who have been really critical to helping sure that our nation has been resilient during this time of pandemic. So people like farm workers, those who kept food on our table, DACA workers themselves, many of them, there's a high number of DACA recipients who have been frontline workers during this time of pandemic. So they're working in the hospitals, they're nurses, they're caregivers, or they're providing food. They're working in the service industry to make sure that we're well fed. So those who have contributed to our resiliency during this time of the pandemic, those who have contributed to our recovery from the mm-hmm. pandemic, there's a sense that maybe we should look at some protections for them too, perhaps as part of this bill. But all of that is highly uncertain. It's really hard, just as it's hard to say which way the courts are going to go, it's also hard to predict what Congress will do. But hopefully we'll see some action on getting folks protections.
Well, so I'm listening to you carefully about that because I just, in my first staff, I was talking about how different media used to be and how it is now, especially with the competition of social media and the proliferation of that. So too, mm-hmm. Dylan is Congress. I mean, on both sides, the House and the Senate, but certainly the House. And yep. So that's what people, that's where we see things get mired down. And so something will pass only if, say, as you said, a reconciliation goes through. But then things are tacked on there that are completely unnecessary to the topic because people want to get their issues in there. And then the other side says, well, I can't accept that at all. We just want to get this one issue through. So to that point, you one would think, Dylan, that so what do you think that Congress might be able to do for reconciliation that would be bipartisan to get to agree to whatever would end this crisis, to get that kind of help through Congress and to end this crisis? Because it certainly ought to be able to be done in a bipartisan way that both parties could agree to, if it's possible that they can leave their other stuff outside of the reconciliation.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think this is certainly not an ideal situation where we have to deal with big issues via non-regular procedures like reconciliation. And I think this is one of the reasons that the United States bishops have said we need comprehensive immigration reform, that Congress needs to take up comprehensive immigration reform. But that's just not very, because of what you just, how you've described it, Congress is very polarized right now. And it's very difficult to get important legislation through in a bipartisan way. Ideally, I think what we could do is, in a bipartisan way, I do think if we can recognize the shared sacrifices that have been made during this time of pandemic by our frontline
right.
workers, and those have been disproportionately folks who have been beneficiaries of DACA, those have been our farm workers, many of those have been recipients of temporary protected status. Those are the folks that have kept us fed, that have kept us safe, that have kept us strong and resilient as a country during this time of pandemic. If we can get some basic minimum protections for them through this reconciliation process, I think that would be a win. That doesn't solve the broader question of immigration reform, which we still need. So hopefully we can get some basic protections for people so that they're not at the whims of the courts and the partisanship that happens over issues like this. And then we can move hopefully to some bipartisan reform that fixes the system, which I think everyone broadly recognizes is broken right now.
It certainly is, like so much else, what's not broken health. We used to say, and it's not that it's been fixed, but before COVID, the healthcare industry is broken. Healthcare reform is broken. Everything's, education system is broken. There's a lot that's broken. But one by one, you know, roll up our sleeves, we approach things, and we know good members of Congress who are really working hard to find bipartisan measures that will go through on different issues. On this issue, this is such a hot potato or a hot football, as we know, Dylan. The issue of immigration at our southern border. Dylan Corbett is my guest. I'm Sheila Logminas in for Drew today. And we're talking about the DACA, what you know as DACA, but what you may not know is what that stands for, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals Program. A lot of people feel very strongly about this for one reason or another, but you may have questions now that you have someone here who's working at the border in the Hope Border Institute program. His name is Dylan Corbett. You can call in 888-914-9149. Have a caller on hold now. I'll take right straight ahead. That's what we're talking about, straightening this out, where it is in the courts and where it is in Congress. Immigration at the border and the Deferred Childhood Action for Childhood Arrivals. More on that next.
Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the relevant radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
Get caught up on this conversation and all the others by going to the Relevant Radio Archives. Just search for The Drew Mariani Show.
Hi, this is The Drew Mariani Show. I'm Sheila Logminas in for Drew today, talking about the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program known as DACA. It's one of those hot potato issues, hot button issues in politics, actually, and policy. But listen, we have to be involved in the political process. Our bishops teach us that, because it's through politics that policy is made, and we want moral policy. Well, a lot of people might disagree on what moral policy is at the border, especially when it comes to children. The DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals Program, was instituted under then President Barack Obama, and it was started to deal with children who came to the United States illegally, who were minors when they crossed the border with their parents. Before DACA was started, those children could be deported back to their country of origin once they reached the age of 18. But some of them have been living here for almost their entire lives. So there was a lawsuit that was filed by Texas and other states saying that by implementing that program, President Obama violated the Constitution by undermining Congress's authority on immigration. And just to reset here, for if you didn't hear the earlier part of this conversation, that suit by Texas last Friday, federal judge blocking new applications for DACA. My guest is Dylan Corbett, executive director of the Hope Border Institute, which you can find at hopeborder.org. We're talking about that issue and about what Hope Border Institute does. We'll get back to that in a moment. Our number is 888-914-9149. If you hold either strong positions about DACA and the children coming with their parents over the border, or you're just so uncertain and confused about it, Dylan is a good person to ask. 888-914-9149. So Dylan, we had a caller a little bit ago who wanted to ask a question. I can put that question out for him, but right now I'm going to take John from Florida. He's calling in at this moment. John, go ahead. I'm glad you called.
Well, thank you. So I first wanted to clarify something. I heard earlier that 15,000 children or some number of children arrived at the border. They came to the border unaccompanied. Let's be clear. Those children were sent to the border. 8-year-old children don't make a decision to pack up and leave their country and travel 1,000 miles to go to another country. So they were sent here because the people who sent them know that we'll bring them in, and that those people then can join their children because we have the family unification program. My parents came here from Europe, and they immigrated the proper way. They waited forever to get here. They came here in the 1930s to avoid, you know, fascism in Europe. Mm-hmm. And they did it the right way. And I don't see why we had a president who thought he could just write his own law and create the DACA program. If that's the case, he could have done it legally through the Congress the first 2 years he had a full majority in the Senate and in the House. and enough to override a filibuster. He didn't choose to do it. He chose to do it on his own using this DACA program. So it just, it's very annoying for us to see that, you know, this president taking power into their own hands, any president. We have a democracy. We have a legislature, and we should follow the rules. And that's it.
Dylan, how do you answer that? And by the way, so that added to the fact that isn't it the case that in the past waves of immigrants who did cross the border with children were people bringing their own children, and in more recent times we've seen just floods of children being sent, as the caller says, over just by themselves and gangs of children or hordes of children.
Yeah, we've seen over the last decade, if not a little bit longer, has been an increase in the amount of unaccompanied children coming to the border. And it's complex. They come for a number of different reasons. Right now, a lot of them, for example, are coming from Honduras. And Honduras was just devastated last year. At the end of last year, there was a 1-2 punch with a couple of hurricanes that displaced a lot of people and really just ravaged many communities and made them unlivable. And so that's been one of the drivers that has driven many of those unaccompanied children to the border, that when families just, they see no other option. And they know, for example, that they might be one of those families that might be returned to Mexico. They might make that choice to send their children over. And it's important to say that when we receive children at the border, unaccompanied minors, that's a legal process. There was a law that was signed by George W. Bush, and the law was put into place. It was bipartisan, both Democrats and Republicans passed the law in order to make sure that we guarantee the safety of children. Because if we return them immediately to their countries of origin or back over to the border to Mexico, we risk putting them into difficult situations. We risk putting them into situations of trafficking and smuggling that are not in the child's interest. Now, while those children are here, they can't petition for their relatives to come. They're here basically because the George W. Bush law puts a floor in place so that there's an element of due process so that they can make their case in the courts. And so they'll have an opportunity to make that case in the courts. But it's complex. The drivers that are driving children to the border, many of them from Central America, many of them fleeing things like the hurricanes. In Guatemala right now, hunger and child hunger has gone up in the last couple of years, which is really troubling. And so we're seeing a lot of children coming as a result of those circumstances. But the intention is of our government in receiving these children is to make sure that they have a degree of due process to make their asylum claims.
I'll fit my question in after this next caller, but that gets to, just to put this thought out there, due process is make a way through the appeal for citizenship or to be able to stay. It's hard to imagine how children are going to be able to do that, but you can answer that in a minute because we've got some callers. John from Florida was the one who just expressed that, how his parents did it from Europe and then how these people are doing it from Central America, Mexico, from wherever, the Guatemala, when you bring up the different places they're coming in from. So people, again, have all sorts of feelings or questions, impressions, but we want clarity and we want information. And so that's why we hope that's what you're bringing. We appreciate that. Dylan Corbett is my guest. I'm Sheila Logman. It's in for Drew. He is the director of Hope Border Institute, hopeborder.org. And we have a call, Kevin in Northern California. Kevin, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Thank you. I kind of echo John's sentiments. My family immigrated here legally from Ireland, and you can't even legally immigrate here from Europe now. It's very difficult, so it's very frustrating. I have cousins who have wanted to immigrate here, and to see people just walk over the border here, encouraged many times by our politicians. Joe Biden created this crisis by telling people, come. During a pandemic, while we're walking around with masks. But my question is, why would Americans with children in particular be for this? And that sounds like an odd question. And I don't mean to be uncharitable. I'm sure there are many good reasons why people from all over the world would want to send their children here. But I've seen in my own experience, I'm an advocate for a major university in the United States, and these kids continue to get benefits. Not only do they get into the country through an illegal process, but then once they're here, they get educational benefits. And let me explain. They get priority getting into admissions into our most elite universities if they have decent grades over more qualified citizen children. They get free tuition once they're here.
Kevin, yeah. So, Dylan, of the things Kevin raised, understandably, a lot of people are raising these questions too. To your mind, Dylan, what's the most important point he made in terms of a question a lot of people are wondering?
Yeah, I sympathize with the caller. I'm a dad. You know, I have two children. My daughter, she's 12, and my son just turned 8. And I can't imagine having to send my children. You know, the desperation that would lead me to send my child to take a journey of over 2,000 miles. It was dangerous. But I think that speaks to the desperation. I think that speaks to the really difficult and challenging circumstances that people are forced to make, the terrible decisions that people and parents have to make.
On that note, I'm going to direct people to hopeborderinstitute.org.